This week I'm doing a little presentation on phishing. So basically, what is phishing? This is a type of social engineering attack in which an attacker impersonates a trusted entity. Attacker attempts to retrieve privileged information by exploiting the trust that they've got because they're impersonating a trusted entity. A lot of times you'll find that this includes credit cards because everybody wants credit card numbers. It's also likely to include username or password because you can do a lot of damage with a banking password. Heck, you can do a lot of damage with a Facebook password. And of course, in fact, it can be any information at all that the attacker wants. So what is email phishing? Well, this is a really common form of phishing because it's really easy. It's just like creating spam mail. I go make my email. Since there's no inherent security in emails, that is to say, there's no way for me to identify who actually sent the email with the standard email protocol, forging a header to make it look like it's sent by the trusted entity I'm spoofing is really easy. A lot of times the attacker will pretend to be a bank, PayPal, Facebook, something like that. Even bank employees have fallen for bank-related phishing. And of course, you know, that royalty from a particular African state out there is just really fond of doing this, apparently. So the increase of HTML email makes it even easier to phish. This is because of a variety of things. One is because images can be embedded in an email, and that allows you to, as an attacker, to avoid filters that'll check texts. In fact, that email might only be an image. HTML code also allows an attacker to make a link that appears to be pointing somewhere legitimate, so it might say facebook.com, but it's actually pointing somewhere else, say horribly malicious site run by Nate. In fact, it might even say, you know, that the HTML code could let you say Luke's lasers, and so Luke thinks he's connecting back to his old website, and it's actually taking him to Nate's special site set up to impersonate Luke's site. Anyway, since it looks attractive, people are often more trusting of HTML email over, say, text email. Personally, I prefer to use text email for mostly because I like to sign my emails. So are there questions about email phishing?
I just have one little point to make, and I don't know if you're going to get into this later in the slideshow, but I noticed one thing that can be done on web pages a long time ago. I don't know if they can still do this, so it would stand to reason they can. And that is change what's written in the address bar after the web page is loaded.
That's correct. There are various techniques. This is email phishing, though, so give me time. Give me time. In fact, give me right now. So website forgery is another aspect of phishing or another approach to phishing. This is one of the common mechanisms to exploit a victim because you can make a site that looks like a legitimate site but is actually at a different but similar looking address. That's one way to do it. So facebook.com with the O's replaced with zeros looks kind of like you're actually at facebook.com. Anyway, anything the victim enters at this site is compromised. Now, like Luke mentioned, you can, in fact, do URL rewriting after the fact through various mechanisms. One of the more entertaining ones is to actually control an image and place an image over the top of the URL, because you can't always change the URL, but you can place an image over top of it with JavaScript, in which case it looks like you're at the legitimate site entirely. There's no way to tell otherwise. Well, there might be a couple tricks. For instance, if I tried to click on it and highlight and change it, that might not work so well. But if you made a complex enough JavaScript attack on it, yeah, or JavaScript program, you probably could do it. Anyway, one of the other things that forged websites might do is deliver malware. So, you know, you go to the site, you're running IE6 because you're not very bright, XP Windows, of course, you know, maybe just ME because, you know, obviously you're a glutton for punishment. And you go to that site, ActiveX is still enabled. You immediately download the software that they're giving to you because you don't even have the option to reject it. And bam, there you go. You've got that rootkit on your system and you're having all sorts of fun. So there are questions about website forgery. So another approach to phishing is phone phishing. This requires a lot more effort than email phishing, which is why you probably haven't had many problems with this. This is actually really likely to succeed if the attacker has enough confidence, because most people, quite frankly, trust phones more than like electronic mediums. So a lot of people, because they don't think it through, think that because they're getting a phone call, it is automatically safer than if you get an email from someone. Not really, because you can't actually tell who it is calling you unless you know them well enough to know their voice, and you might not even do that.
Well, there's a lot of telephone listening devices too, right? So you don't know who might be listening.
Yeah, but that's not phishing. That is security related, but not phishing related. Anyway, so I've been reading security engineering lately, and he was involved with the British medical industry for quite a while, and they had done a bunch of studies that show that medical facilities often reveal information to callers who just sound legitimate. So the main problem he referenced was private detectives calling into a hospital and being able to get information just by pretending that they were another like a clinic or another hospital needing information about a particular patient, because the people answering the phone didn't know any better and there were no security checks in place. He did find, well, I'll talk about that in the defenses. Anyway, this is usually going to target an organization rather than an individual because, as I said, it takes more effort and you don't really want to expend that effort unless there's bigger payoffs. So any questions about phone phishing?
Did you guys hear the news that nurse commits suicide in Britain? There's some Australian DJ playing a prank on them.
I completely forgot about that. That was, it had to do, I want to say, with the
Prince
of Wales.
Prince William's right. His wife got pregnant and he commits suicide.
Well, I mean, the main problem with that is the fact that the hospitals are not training their employees. It all goes back to the same thing. I've said it in probably every presentation I get. How do you defend against things? Well, step number one, educate your users. Nobody wants to spend the money on it. Any other questions, comments? Spear phishing. This is just targeted phishing. This is where attackers will learn details about victims to make themselves appear more trustworthy and just to engender that trust with the victim. Generally, this targets a high-profile individual because, again, it's like phone phishing. If you're going to put this much effort into doing it, you want to make sure that the results are worthwhile. And this is becoming more common as people are starting to become more educated about phishing, so your regular run-of-the-mill phishing attempts don't work as well. Questions? So this is a less common thing, and it's something that isn't a major problem, but I liked the name, so I went ahead and referenced it. So this is Evil Twin. Well, this is when you create a wireless access point that looks legitimate, but it can actually be spied upon. So this is like if I were to make a wireless access point here that said UAH Student Wireless. Well, that's not a legitimate wireless access point. The naming doesn't actually conflict with the UAH access points, but it looks like it's a real one. So if you were to connect to this, I would be able to read everything going on there. So anyway, you know, I might want to get Facebook credentials again because, hey, who doesn't want Facebook credentials? And really stupid people might actually use banking passwords, send banking passwords over somebody else's wireless. Yeah, bad idea. Of course, most banks now do use SSL, but still, not a good thing. Questions about this approach? All right, so we'll head into the defense aspects. Well, I've already mentioned this briefly. The main defense is training. User education is important. Users should not click on links in email. Emails should refer them to a known trusted location if they're going to be sending information like this at all. This prevents a user from being sent to a fake site through like the HTML mechanisms I mentioned. Users should not trust unexpected emails even if they are actually legitimate. If the user doesn't know why this is coming to them, say it's a health behavior survey, they should not be going and following that link. They should also be trained to verify messages through alternate channels. So basically what I mean by this, if you're called by someone asking for information, you shouldn't just trust that number, even if caller ID says it's the number you expect, because caller IDs can be spoofed. You should, in fact, go look up in like a phone book or some other verifiable means for having their actual phone number and call them back. Emails the same way. Emails, unless you're using signing, you can't even reply back to a known email address. They're so easy to forge. They're so easy to intercept. Emails are just not a trustworthy channel for authenticating someone. And one of the other parts of training is performing random tests on employees to see if they fall for phishing. Now, the thing I was starting to mention earlier is there was actually another study done by the security folks in Britain on one of the hospitals. They went and they trained a bunch of the nurses and staff to do exactly what I mentioned here. If someone calls you, you call back through a known number. You go look up in a phone book and you see if that's really a valid number, and you call them and you see if that was a valid telephone call. And in fact, this dropped the incident rate on phishing, of successful phishing, down to like less than 1%, whereas before it was some absurdly high amount that I can't remember. At any rate, I mean, that just goes to show a little bit of user training can go a long ways. You just have to be willing to spend the time and a little bit of money. It's better than most of the technological approaches. Anyway, questions on training as a defense? So the next portion of defenses is policy. This goes hand in hand with training. Policy should exist as to what is sent or requested in emails. So you should never ever send credentials via email. It's just a bad idea all around. Links also, quite frankly, shouldn't be sent. I should not be following a link from an email, like I said. You should communicate what is expected in emails. This is what makes user training effective, so that they know that this looks suspicious and I should follow up on it with a different mechanism, a different authentication channel. IT must always follow this policy or else they actually actively undo the user training. It's just like a dog. You can't tell it, you can't randomly change how you're giving it commands or it gets confused and it loses all its training. Questions about policy? All right, so the next aspect is using technology. Well, the obvious approach is trying to filter out phishing attempts. This is always a trade-off between false accept rate, so that's when you get something through that you don't want to get through, so it's a phishing attempt that did get through your filter, and an insult rate, which is incorrect rejections. The filters on emails are obviously a nifty little first defense. They prevent the obvious phishing attempts, so I am the Prince of Nigeria with weird capitalization schemes, very odd misspellings, and strange spacing. They scan the content for suspicious messages. They can look for image-only emails because those are uncommon, although I do know some marketers that think they're smart. And it can check for suspicious links. So the next aspect, I've already mentioned this briefly, is email signatures. Well, this is a great way to give assurances to the original sender using something like OpenPGP or something that has a more centralized way to verify signatures either. Also, once you can trust a key, if you assume that the sender has not leaked their key, you can trust that that email is actually from that sender. Of course, then the sender also can't, you know, forget their password or lose their private key file. But, if it gets shot away by a laser, what can you do? Caller ID can be used to spot suspicious numbers. This is really only a first line of defense because an attacker can still spoof caller ID. But it's something that I can say, well, this is a caller ID that makes absolutely no sense for what they're asking, so I'm just going to hang up now. Anyway, no technology approach works as well as good user education and, of course, policy. Any questions about the technology approaches I mentioned? All right, so now I have a case study, completely de-identified from the original organization doing this. This organization sends out an email from a generic email address, you know, something that's not associated with any particular user, anyone who's particularly well-known within an organization. It's effectively anonymous. This states that a health survey, one that's going to ask about personally identifiable information, stuff that can be used for blackmail, personally identifiable information and could be used for blackmail, I should say. And it says that this will be sent out to random people. It provides contact information that can be used to verify the email in form of a phone number. Well, the reason why I mention that specifically is because that's an additional barrier that most people just aren't going to be bothered to call that phone number. And even if they do, there's this good chance that you won't get a response because it's not asynchronous. So about a week later, a second email is sent out. This email is from a completely different domain and different user than the first email. It links to a survey form on an external site. When I say external site in this case, I mean that is on a completely different domain than the one that the first email came from. So, by the way, it's also different than the domain that email came from, that the second email came from. So basically, at this point, we've had three different domains. This external site has no well-known or obvious affiliation with the original organization, and of course it uses HTML to provide one of those clickable links that we all love because they're so convenient. This second email also contains the original contact and phone number, so it does reference back the original stuff. There's also a new organizational email listed. This email does not appear on the organization's website, so you can't actually verify that it will work at all, and no further alternative channels were offered. So I'll ask a question, see if anyone has any thoughts. What suggests to you that this could be a phishing attempt? So no one's got any ideas why this could be a phishing attempt. I mean, Luke said all of the above, but he didn't give any specifics.
Well, I mean, it's coming from the first email is already coming from a questionable site as far as I'm concerned. I wouldn't have even looked at the first email because it's not even coming from a web address that I would trust. But
why wouldn't you trust it, Lou?
Because it's not coming from the same site as the
Well, no, that's your first email.
First email comes from the organization that's asking for the survey.
I mean, that should look like a legitimate link, shouldn't it?
Well, the email...
Or did the email not get
legitimate, yes.
But there were some other things that you mentioned about the first email that just...
So
like telltale signs where I was like, no, first email is not something I would respond to.
So, and remember...
So it's a health survey, one which asks about personal identifiable information. I would not answer... You know, personally identifiable information.
Which is wise. So,
but it does provide contact information.
It does provide it in the form of a phone number.
Which would make it seem a bit more legitimate.
Which makes it seem a bit more legitimate.
Right.
But what happens if, for say, I pick somebody who I know is going to be out of town that week and put their phone number on that email? So that might
be a good sign that...
But that's exactly my point, though, is it makes
right.
it look more legitimate, but
right.
is it really?
Right, exactly.
So,
I mean, if somebody told me that email was, like, important and I had to reply to it, then I would probably just call that telephone number.
Probably. But a lot of people are stupid and aren't going to do that.
So this email, this phone number makes it look more legitimate. That's the point, is... As an attacker, I know that providing that email makes it look more legitimate. Also, remember that this first email could be sent by a forged sender. And in fact, that phone number may be pointing to my phone number. That may not even be a legitimate phone number. Now, you could go look this up on the organizational website, but even that has some risks associated with it. Because remember, websites are easy to hack. It's not like a phone book. And of course, that person's number was not available in the phone book, the organizational phone book. Which wasn't actually available anywhere except online. So I mean, I could provide the contact information, even if it's legitimate contact information. If I was sending a forged email, it might be for someone out of town. This would lower the defenses of people who might just distrust a totally random email. They might say, well, this is legitimate information, so it must be real. I won't bother calling that number. As an attacker, that second email, I could just send out. I could take advantage of the first email, and I could actually go make my own domain that looks that is legitimate. It is legitimately my domain. I'm not forging the email in this case. And I could send this out. So even if the first email was legitimate, as an attacker, if I received that first email, I might go send out my own email that is trying to take advantage of this. It wouldn't be very hard to do that if you were on the list of people who received from that first email, and you know, you could be taken in by that. So were there any other points that anyone else have any other thoughts of why it might be a phishing attempt?
So, and then you would click on some link probably on that second email. They'll bring you to a page asking you to enter personal information.
Yeah, there would be that link could point to a malicious site. It could infect the victim with malware, like I've mentioned previously, or it could send back the survey that appears to be a legitimate survey back to the attacker. And of course, This survey is looking for stuff like sexual orientation. Well, that can be used to blackmail people. The attacker could certainly identify individuals. Now, this email claimed to de-identify individuals, but if you go do a little bit of research about de-identifying personally identifiable information, it's very hard to do, nearly impossible to do. And in fact, there's information tracing back to, like, at the very least, the 60s and 70s, when the U.S. Census was attempting to de-identify people. Really interesting stuff, and if I have some time to do some more research, I'd actually like to do a presentation on it, because it's interesting stuff. Really is.
Then what do you mean to de-identify?
It's basically trying to make it anonymous. So you're taking identifiable information and removing the stuff that makes it identifiable while keeping value from having it. So it's like if you're doing a health behavior survey because you're a researcher for medical field, you're trying to make it so that even though you have this information, you can't identify individuals. Unfortunately, like I said, it's really hard, but we'll get into that one of these days because great stuff. Anyway, because most users are not trained to realize that this is a big problem, that they shouldn't be doing it, many of them will respond and fill out the survey, and, well, that could be bad.
Well, I think it really has to do with the way one sees email in the first place. I think too many people see email as like the equivalent to a telephone call or the equivalent to a message over mail, over snail mail or whatever. They see it as equivalent to that, and it's definitely not. I mean, it's like going up to somebody's house with a megaphone and yelling a message to them.
It's even more
anybody in the area can hear it. Anybody who just happens to be in the area can possibly get the message.
And that's true. And actually, the fact that emails can be forged is why it's really a problem. I mean, the privacy is, for phishing, the context of phishing, that's not particularly important. I mean, it isn't because of the first email, but normally it wouldn't matter much. But because emails are so easy to forge, that's a big deal, and most people don't recognize that.
Email is relatively insecure.
Almost completely.
Really?
Yeah.
Like compared to TCP/IP, or I mean, you have to have, what, SSL?
Even with SSL, because of the way email works, it's really easy to forge. The only way...
Like Telnet, I mean, anybody can watch it.
Well, it's not that, I mean, again, that's a confidentiality issue. Phishing is about authentication, right? So we're concerned about authentication in this case. So emails, I can go make a mail server, write my header out that says eugene@uah.edu, which is not a valid address, and send it through my mail service. And it will look to you when I send you that email like it is from somebody called eugene@uah.edu. Well, that's relatively innocuous. But let's say I forged a header that said john@uah.edu, sent that along and sent that with a death threat to someone. You could be in serious trouble. And that has happened before. There have been problems where that's occurred. It's really easy to do.
But I mean, like, that would be, it would be tough to break or to get within, let's say, like, Google's Gmail servers, would it not?
You don't have to be within Google's servers. That's not a problem. I can forge the email. Emails are just, SMTP servers are just dumb receptors most of the time. You send them a mail, they do what you've told them to. They don't authenticate, they don't check to make sure it makes sense. They're stupid.
So it's insecure from an authentication point of view.
And from a confidentiality standpoint. It's insecure, period, basically. Now, you can use email encryption and signing to fix a lot of these problems. Here's an alternate question, or a secondary question. Assume that the emails are legitimate. What problems does this suggest about organizational policy? They're effectively training users to trust emails sent without verifying them. So one of those big no-nos. The organization is training users to follow links in emails. The organization should not have sent out an email warning about the survey because that gives the an attacker the time to take advantage and send out the second email. They impersonate the second email and get people to fall for that approach. Anything else? Anybody else got anything they want to contribute here? Basically, it suggests that there's all sorts of problems at that organization. So just to sum things up real quick, phishing is the attempt to trick users into giving away information. It's often done over email, sometimes with a website as well. It can also even be done over a phone. The best defense against phishing is to have strong user education, and strong policy in place for what to send in emails. Any questions about phishing in general? And I'll go ahead and mention my references. Counterhack Reloaded shows up on all of them, I know. Security Engineering, I've been reading this book. You can get it for free off his website. I'm going to try to remember to email out a link. It's actually, I've read about halfway through it. I would say it's a fairly good book. Depending on what you're interested in, the later half of it may not be as interesting, but it's a very good introduction to computer security and indeed security in general. There's actually a chapter on physical security. He even talks about bump keys. And, you know, it's you can get a free copy, a PDF. He does sell a paper copy, but it's expensive.